All right. I feel like we have to touch this again, because I feel like we didn't get to a conclusion. But I think that, what's her name?
Tilly Devine?
Yeah, Tilly Devine. She looked like if you and McGregor got stung by bees.
We got this covered in the last episode, Sally.
And I just wanted to touch on it again.
You wanted to touch on Ewan McGregor?
Is that Listen, I would touch on Ewan McGregor.
His standards
He's married, though.
If his standards were low enough.
Does he like millennial garbage? Is this a good time to plug our third podcast,
yes.
Millennial Garbage?
Yeah, it's just going to be more goofs, lots of laugh.
And maybe some tabletop games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because none of us have played Dungeons & Dragons yet.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know about y'all, but I think, when we were living together, we were always like, oh, I wanted to do this, I've always wanted to try that. So we wanted to have a podcast where we explore those avenues instead of just saying... we're going to do this.
Yeah. Also, Eric, who I work with, Eric showed me this tabletop game. It's called Seven Candles or something. I think I sent it to you guys on Facebook, but it's where you light however many tea candles, and at each round, one of the candles gets extinguished. And that's really cool. I think we should do that, because it requires no setup, really.
So it has to be tea candles, not scented candles.
I mean, it could be scented candles. But do you really want seven different scented candles going
at the same time?
Yeah,
it would just smell like just vanilla. Like how...
it would smell like a Yankee Candle shop.
Yeah, but it just smells like vanilla, which is just...
it just smells like soapy wax.
And it's just... it gives you a headache.
I can't walk into those stores.
Can you go to Bath & Body Works? Or is that...
yeah. Okay. I have to kind of stay away from all of the candle section. But,
They also have, around the store, throughout the store, they have little jars of, coffee beans, and you could...
yeah, that's true.
Which is lovely.
Yeah, it's great.
See, my grandma has major scent sensitivities and stuff, and she has problems even going in, Bath & Body Works.
I feel like they have their separated out enough. It's not that big of a deal, where Yankee Candle, it's all candles, and that all are scented, and it's just,
all candle all the time.
It's the worst.
Talking about scents and stuff, I just realized I didn't put deodorant on this morning.
Just don't raise your arms. We'll be fine.
Yeah. I'm sorry if my smell offends you. I do have deodorant in my bag, but I'm just too lazy to put it on.
I got to work the other day and realized I forgot to put deodorant on, and it was so hot. By the time I actually got into my work building, I was musty.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, ugh, it's gonna be a long day.
No.
But then I realized we had a spray deodorant in the lady's bathroom.
Oh, okay.
They take care of us.
Yeah.
What are we gonna talk about today?
Well, welcome to Legendary Lasses.
Oh yeah.
I'm Ashley.
I'm KB.
I'm Sally.
And today we thought we would talk about Sappho the poet.
Sappho. Okay.
You tried. It's okay.
She's a one-name lady, like Cher.
Like Madonna.
Yeah, so...
maybe just as scandalous, now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
I love Cher. She's not proud of it.
What's the... do you believe in...
no. You believe in love after love?
That's a pretty good Cher impression.
Thanks.
I always liked her in Burlesque.
I never saw Burlesque.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the best movie ever.
I was not
ever,
sold on Christina Aguilera.
I'm Cher, bitch.
Yeah.
I'm an Oscar winner.
Isn't that
It's Chad Michaels.
Yeah.
Winner of Snatch Game on season 4 of RuPaul's Drag Race.
Mm-hmm.
No. All Stars won. He won Snatch Game.
Yeah.
Then Chad Michaels won all of All Stars 1.
I don't know anything about this.
Ashley, you need to watch Drag Race.
I know.
Yeah.
Drag Race, Priscilla Queen of the Desert,
a little busy.
And Tu Wong Fu.
So I just got one of those Amazon Fire Sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And one night I really wanted to watch Drag Race. And it has, the little Alexa remote that you can talk to her and tell her to search for stuff.
Yeah.
So I kept saying, Alexa, search for Drag Race. And she would say, there's no books called Drag Race. And I was like, Alexa, you idiot. And so I would go to Netflix and be like, search Drag Race. And there's no Drag Race on Netflix. And
no.
I just kept, searching through all these apps for Drag Race. It was so sad.
There was another time when we were watching something together and you had asked her to search for something, and even in Netflix, she was like, there's no books titled.
So Alexa's stupid. A little bit, well,
no, she just wants you to read
her
more.
Best. Yeah, yeah.
Look, I'm reading the title. That's it. Or if I'm watching Drag Race, I'll be reading people.
Yeah.
I don't know if you should.
Reading is fundamental.
You guys, we have a history podcast.
The history of reading! We should watch. That's another documentary you should watch. It's called Paris is Burning, and it's on Netflix.
That sounds very familiar.
I talked about it. It's very good.
Okay.
You should watch it.
Paris is Burning. Okay. Well, anyway, Sappho. She's an ancient Greek poet. So, since we're going way far back, I wanted to go ahead and define some terms because I think that might be very helpful in this situation. I want some hummus. Oh, I really want some hummus.
Is hummus Greek?
Mediterranean.
I miss, more so than the Greek, but never mind. This is not at all germane to our discussion. But
the Greek place on campus?
Yeah, but before that it was the wok or something. And you
they
could
had
get
the best
dollar
rice.
Fried rice.
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
So good.
So they had meals and stuff that were like normal price of everything else, but if you asked for just the fried rice,
it was
$1.
And it was like,
yeah, and it was a big thing of fried rice. And you can add like peanuts and sauces to it and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was so good and so cheap.
Fuck me up.
It was amazing.
So anyway, for our terms, I want to go ahead and define what these terms mean in historical research. So the terms we're going to be defining are fragments, primary source, and secondary source.
Okay.
So for a fragment, it can be a physical artifact or a document that is worn or has missing pieces. And in the case of Sappho's poetry, this looks like papyrus scrolls that are damaged. So some of the Greek characters are missing, or it's just ineligible?
Illegible.
Thank you. Illegible. I can speak English real good.
It is ineligible for this contest.
My English is good.
But this term fragments can also be defined as documents that are mentioned in secondary sources that we have instead of the primary source.
Okay.
So that might be where we're getting some of her fragments. So the primary source in the study of history is a artifact, document, diary, manuscript, autobiography, recording, or any other source of information that was created at the time under study. It serves as an original source of information about the topic. Whereas a secondary source in scholarship is a document or recording that relates or discusses information that was originally presented elsewhere.
So it's like when someone writes a research paper and it's like on the internet, right?
Yeah, that could be a secondary source. I'd be careful with that.
Yeah, like,
but yeah. I would say it's more of like a Greek philosopher mentions a document that we don't have, like Sappho's poetry, and we can't use him as a primary source, but he's a secondary source and talking about Sappho.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, I'm thinking of something else, but okay, that's awesome. Okay,
I get it. Shift sometimes, I think, too, depending on what, because say, you know, we have Sappho and her poetry, and then you have something written about her maybe in the 1800s or something. I'm not sure.
Right.
So that's a secondary source for Sappho, but it's a primary source for what they in the 1800s thought about her.
Right, yeah. Like it would be a primary source if you were doing Victorian ideas of Greek poetry or something.
Yeah,
great.
So it can shift.
Yeah, it can shift, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But that gets us into Sappho's work, actually. A lot of her work is still fragmented today. I was reading a couple of articles that say we only have probably 2 complete poems at this time, which is shocking since she's probably written about 10,000 lines. And what that means for us is we only have about 650 of those lines.
Wow.
Which is a crazy low amount.
Yeah,
crazy.
We know that she probably had about 9 volumes of poetry published while she was alive. And that's, it's kind of it. Like, we don't know a whole lot about her work. Everything's still being put together. The earliest recorded fragment of her work dates to about the 3rd century BC. and the latest surviving copies of Sappho's poems are directly transcribed from ancient times and are written on parchment paper. Those date about to the 6th or 7th century AD. It is possible that manuscript copies of Sappho's work may have survived a few centuries longer, but around the 9th century is when her work seems to disappear. Which leads us to John's... Okay, I'm going to butcher this name, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So help me out. I think it's pronounced Setzies?
Mm-hmm, that looks right.
Setzies?
Oh, yeah.
John Setzies, who was a Byzantine poet writing about the 12th century. And he actually writes, "The passage of time has destroyed Sappho and her works." This is in the 12th century. So it seems like a really long time, but... It also feels like maybe we should have more of her work by now. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Does that kind of seem true for you guys?
As far as we should have found more of her work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, they're finding stuff all the time, I feel like, in little forgotten villages, or you never know when
yeah.
you're going to find something.
I have interesting how we found some of her stuff later on.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. I was told not to look at the notes.
Yeah. Because it's going to be a surprise.
I know nothing this episode. I went to go visit my family the past few days.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm going blind, a little bit blind into this episode. I've heard about her before. I've read some of her poetry
sure.
before. So I'm excited.
Well, we hope to edumacate you.
Yeah.
We're going to learn you a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm a trusty resource, but, you know.
Well, why don't you tell us what we sort of kind of maybe know about Sappho's life?
Yeah, so I'm going to be honest. To this point forward, there's some Greek names, and so I'm going to apologize right now if I butcher any of those names or any of the pronunciations. And also the history of, or like the story of Sappho is...
Fragmented.
Doing my research.
That was a lovely turn of phrase. I don't feel like you guys appreciate it enough. Sorry.
I feel like that's the theme for her life.
Fragmented.
Yeah.
Her poetry's fragments.
Yeah.
Her life,
yeah.
I don't really know much about.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like doing my research, I was finding, well, this might have happened, but maybe not. It might have been this or this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really frustrating. I was typing up my notes today and Ashley saw me.
Dramatically flail is
okay.
how I would describe it.
You make it sound so dramatic.
You? What?
I am the most subtle person I know.
Oh, dear.
You think of Sally and you think subtlety. It starts with the same letter.
Sure. So what do we know?
Sappho was born around 620 BCE on the island of Lesbos, Greece, to an aristocratic family. Because she was born in an aristocratic family, her wealth probably allowed her to live a life of her own choosing. So being a poet.
That would make sense.
Instead of, you know, marrying off to someone and having babies and keeping a house and all of that stuff.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
If I was going to be a lady in ancient Greece, that is the type of lady I would want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lady of leisure.
Yeah. So her parents' names are unknown. I couldn't find anything. There's some speculation that her mother's name was probably Cleus. Am I saying that correctly?
Sure. Cleus?
That is
Cleus?
Way too close to Cletus for me. Like.
That's funny.
Well, and the reason they think that her mother's name was probably that is because Sappho's supposed daughter was named Cleus. I say supposed daughter because there's a couple of her poems that mention Cleus. One is fragment 132, and it reads, "I have a beautiful little girl. The golden flowers are no match for her loveliness. My darling Cleus. For her, I couldn't take all Lydia or sweet." So... she might have been referring to her daughter. Cleus could also refer to the quote-unquote youthful beloved in a male homosexual liaison, suggesting that Cleus was one of Sappho's younger lovers.
So this is an interesting phrase, because I've not heard this word used to describe that.
Me neither. But I saw that on a lot of articles and
I mean, of course, I don't study ancient Greece either, so
no.
I think that's probably part of it.
I do eat some Greek food, though.
Okay.
It's
that should help.
Well, Greek food aside, she was said to have had three brothers, I'm going to butcher these three names.
These are rough.
Aregius, Laricus?
Laricus?
Laricus? And
Caraxes.
I was going to say Caraxes, probably.
These sound like names of Pokemon.
They do.
Caraxes, I choose you.
They just sound like ancient Greek.
Yeah.
So we know the brothers' names, but not her parents'
names? Not her parents' names.
What did her brother... I mean, did her brothers do anything?
I don't know.
I mean, we're not talking about them here, so I guess it doesn't matter, but...
Yeah. Well, Sappho and her family, at one point, were exiled from Lesbos to Sicily around 600 BC because of politics.
Did they get their family fortune stolen away from them as well?
I don't know, actually. Did they?
I don't know.
Well, if she continued to live her life of leisure,
probably
I'm
not.
Say,
yeah.
They took all of the family money with them. They're like, we're not coming back here.
Yeah.
And she's also said to have operated a school for girls in, on Lesbos. But doing some more research on that, it shows that maybe it wasn't. It might have been just a ladder, like a ladder. I'm really dumb. A later invention of the 19th century. It probably confused.
I feel like ladder would have worked
ladder,
there as well. A ladder invention of the 19th century.
I tried to sound fancy.
You are so fancy.
Actually, I think you're the one that sounds fancy, because in our group message you kept
speaking French.
Tu es très fantasy. That's what my BA got me.
I don't know what that means, but...
You are very fancy, I'm guessing.
Yes.
I'm not fancy.
You are a fancy broad.
Okay.
I'm trying to lift you up and compliment you, Sally.
That's funny. Well, so Sappho might have been, they might have confused her with her protege, Damophila, right? Damophila?
Sure. You mean like running the school?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Who was, like I said, a protege of Sappho, who ran his girls' school in Pamphylia?
Pamphylia.
I'm so smart. I'm so fucking smart.
You are. I'm proud of you.
I know.
Okay.
And all that's known is that she was raised learning the lyre, which is an instrument. Uh-huh. And
oh, I wish we had lyre music instead of the pluck intro.
Yeah. Mm.
It would be so good for... Maybe I'll look for some and change up our theme song.
And she also composed songs, which probably influenced her poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Because lots of her poems were meant to have been sung or accompanied by a lyre. Hence the term lyrical poetry.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is like a trademark of Greek poetry. Like it's meant to be more of a ballad, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting that we kind of only know her as the only female... poet to do such and exceed at it.
Yeah.
I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, she did have, she might have had a daughter. she might have gotten married.
Okay.
We don't know. But and also the manner of Sappho's death is unknown.
Wait, what do you mean?
So, from what I was reading, either she died of old age.
Okay.
Or, it's, Athenian playwright, Menander. Started a legend that she committed suicide by throwing herself off a cliff over the unrequited love of a ferryman.
Whoa!
And I think...
So, if she couldn't have that ferryman, she was going to go see Charon?
I guess so.
Who's the ferryman?
Who is the ferryman?
And...
Okay.
Wait, sorry. Ferryman as in he operated a ferry or he was a ferry?
No. Operated a ferry.
Okay. I was a little bit confused. I thought I had a great play on words, but no.
No,
I had a great reference to Charon because he operated the ferry.
Yeah, but I thought it was like fairy, like the fae, and that's what I'm saying. And then I said, but Charon was the ferryman. And so, no.
Got you.
But all of them were ferrymen.
All of them. Okay, so Greek playwright.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say exaggerated.
Yeah, because I was reading some other, from one resource that they started this legend to make her not appear as a lesbian. being like, she liked dudes. She threw herself off a cliff due to the unrequited love from a dude.
Oh my gosh, we can't just let ladies die in peace, can we?
I've got mixed feelings about this.
Right?
Also, okay. When he started this legend, was it in a play? Or was it just like, hey, did you guys hear?
I don't know. I couldn't find anything.
I want to see if I can find a play about Sappho by him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Menander.
But
sounds like Newt Scamander.
Mm. Yeah.
Did he catch Fantastic Beasts? Did he know where to find them?
What? Talking about Sappho.
Oh, sorry.
She was widely regarded as one of the greatest lyric poets. And she was given names such as the 10th Muse and the Poetess.
And there's a lot of her image that's on Greek urns and probably some statues. So for a female poet, she's pretty widely known and regarded as a great poet.
Yeah.
Which at this point you may be asking why it is that we don't have more of her work.
Hey, Ashley, why don't we have a lot of Sappho's work?
Well, let me tell you two reasons why that might be. The first is folklore legend that says that Sappho's poetry was lost due to the church disapproving of her morals that her poetry professes. These legends show up in the Renaissance, probably around 1550, when Jerome Cardan, who's an Italian polymath, does a lot of mathematic work, writes that Gregory Nazianzen.
Nazianzen?
Nazianzen? Nazianzen. Let's go with that. Who is a 4th century archbishop of Constantinople, who is sometimes referred to as Gregory the Theologian.
Hmm.
So Jerome Cardan writes that this Gregory the Theologian has publicly destroyed Sappho's work, which we'll come back to a little bit. But at the end of the 16th century, Joseph Justus Scaliger, who is a French religious leader and scholar known for expanding the knowledge of classical history of Greek and Rome to actually include Persian, Babylonian, Jewish, and ancient Egyptian history.
Okay.
So, kind of a cool dude.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, at the end of the 16th century, this Joseph claims that Sappho's works were burned in Rome and Constantinople in 1073 on the orders of Pope Gregory the VII, which is why Jerome writes that Gregory, who is a 10th century bishop, also writes that they're destroyed in Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of have these two accounts from 1550 and at the end of that century, kind of confirming that her works are burned in Constantinople and Rome because of this pope's orders.
That does make sense because if you look at pictures of the actual, like, the fragments,
mm-hmm.
it looks like it was possibly burned and someone tried to get them out. Or maybe just had water damage.
I mean, it's possible. Yeah, there are some pictures of the fragments that we can definitely put up. I mean, there's also, I guess I don't know the time period of it, but there's also many, many libraries that burn at this time as well. So I think it's possible we probably lost some of it there as well.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of people were real into burning libraries for a lot of history.
Yeah.
So it makes me angry on the inside.
I will sometimes have existential crisis moments when I'm laying in bed late at night. I'm like,
mm-hmm.
we've lost so much information.
I get mad about Alexandria specifically.
Yeah, I get mad about Alexandria. There's this movie that Rachel, is it Weisz is in?
Yeah.
Agora. It's called Agora.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, obviously, an agora, the public forum of Greece. But she plays, oh my god, I cannot think of the Greek philosopher's name. The only, like, female Greek philosopher. Ugh, anyway, it doesn't matter. Go watch Agora.
Mm-hmm.
It also has a library burning in it. And, like, this panic of these scholars in this school/library grabbing the important scrolls and running.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like she's staying in there as people are rampaging into this library about to burn it down. And she's still like, but we have to grab these. And it's like, you're going to die. You can't.
Yeah.
And that is, like, a moment that I think about a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I would have been so sad. I would have cried.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's one possibility of why her work isn't more widely collected right now.
Yeah.
It may or may not be true, though. Although we do have those two accounts that kind of seem to confirm that it happened. It is also possible that her work was probably lost due to a loss in demand for it to be copied. Usually copied onto parchment from, like, codexes or manuscripts that kind of held papyri, parchment, vellum, etc., into a book. So it just became a little bit more efficient than copying it because it held together more, but we still lost it, if that makes sense.
Okay.
It's a little bit hard to talk about.
Yeah.
Stuff that doesn't exist, I've just realized.
Yeah.
So it is possible that her work just became less demanded. Although a third option, which might be a little bit more...
You're about to say the hashtag patriarchy. Is that where this...
No, that was the church one.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
This is a little bit more linguistic, I would say.
Oh.
It's possible that her dialect that she used, which is called... I believe it's pronounced the Aelic dialect,
mm-hmm.
Was just too strange.
Oh.
Kind of fell out of fashion. Because the dialect that she uses contains many archaisms and innovations that are absent in other ancient Greek dialects, it's possible just no one was able to copy it.
Oh.
Even during the Roman period, many readers found Sappho's dialect difficult to understand, and a Roman author actually remarked on... what he called its strangeness, which is, like, possible, too. Like, if no one can read it or really understand what she's saying, why do we have it laying around?
Yeah.
So those are, I guess, three possible options.
To me, and I understand that point, is if no one can read it, then why do we have it around? But
yeah.
To me, it's like, you need to keep it around.
Well,
yeah.
The same thing was, like, with Shakespeare, because I remember... Mm-hmm. You know, during, like, the plays and everything, people didn't know what the fuck they were talking. He was talking about. I mean, because, yeah.
I think we also have that problem today, and it's kind of taken on more of a stance of, oh, you don't understand Shakespeare. Well, I do.
Oh, gosh.
But yes. I think when it was first going on, it's very much for the groundlings, you know?
Yeah,
like,
because Also, the...
He's very bawdy.
Yeah, and also the pronunciation they used, it was a little different. They used...
I want to do a production.
In OP?
An OP.
Mm-hmm. Like, they... The people that have OP, or, like, they'll... If it's a new work, like, they'll come and, like,
mm-hmm.
help you write it out in IPA. And it's very... It's really interesting, and it
sounds so much more of the people.
It does, and then also... the language makes a little bit more sense.
It does, yeah.
Just
the flow of it also mm-hmm. makes more sense.
Yeah.
That iambic pentameter feels
yeah.
better.
Another thing is, so, to me, if you go and see a production of Shakespeare and you have no idea what's going on, then that means, to me, that the people involved in the production haven't done enough table work.
Yeah, that's also true.
Because, to me, that's not a... You know, you said some people are like, oh, well, I understand
right.
Shakespeare. And it's, if you make it not understandable,
yeah,
then that means that you haven't dug into it enough and made it so that...
Everyone.
Yeah.
Someone can come up on the street, don't even know who, that, like, they don't even know who Shakespeare is, and
mm-hmm.
they can still understand what...
Yeah.
Are there people who don't know who Shakespeare is?
I don't know.
I would say in English, definitely everyone knows who he is, and even in a lot of other languages too. But
I just found my mission in life.
Oh my gosh,
to make sure everyone knows the word of our Shakespeare. I like what's his name?
See, I love Shakespeare, but I don't think he's the end all be all.
I was just gonna say that, but I couldn't think of the other playwright's name who I wanted to say.
Marlowe.
Yes,
I will go to bat for Marlowe. I love Marlowe. And the thing about
other podcast, we should talk about Marlowe. Despite her obscuring and erasure throughout history, in the very late Victorian period, we do start reading Sappho again. And this is because in 1879, the first Sappho fragment is found in Fayum in Egypt.
Okay.
This is also when we start to attribute the idea of sapphic love to mean relationships or romantic tendencies between women to Sappho's poetry.
So touching, going piggybacking on that, what Ashley was saying, there's a romantic interest in women is very popular throughout Sappho's poetry. Most scholars do advise against reading her works biographically, though.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, because she could have possibly just have written expressing a persona like many poets do during
the ages. Sure, yeah.
But her poems, they have a lot of intimacy and depth of feeling, which does suggest that she was a lesbian, but that doesn't mean she was one.
So it's a good point, because I wanted to talk about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether or not Sappho was a lesbian is, of course, up for debate between anyone, right? To me, it's difficult to place 21st century ideas of sexuality and gender to a historical figure. That we're pulling out of their history, we're pulling out of their social context, we're pulling out of their time context. Because sexuality and gender have gone through so many evolutions, I mean, even fairly quickly, throughout human history, it's something that I'm definitely interested in studying, but I'm kind of on the fence about whether we name historical figures this or that from a 21st century mindset.
Well, also, and I could be wrong, but, like, you know, this was ancient Greece, so, like, everyone was fucking everybody.
Crass way of putting it, sure, but, yeah, like, that's kind of what I mean, right? Like, sexuality, how we think about it, is very, very different from what ancient Greece would have thought about it.
Yeah.
It's very different from what ancient China would have thought about it. You
it's
know, like
it's different from what we thought about 50 years ago.
Yeah, like, let alone millennia.
Because I know people even debate about figures like Freddie Mercury, who weren't even, you know, it wasn't that long ago, but people still debate, you know, is he gay? Was he bisexual? Like, there's kind of an odd, and we don't really know because he's not here to tell us he was one or the other. So
And, like, this is why I'm on the fence about it, though. It's like, at the same time, I don't want to take part in LGBTQ history erasure.
Yeah.
And so I guess that's where, as a scholar, I'm on the fence of how do we talk about this. But I don't know. It's a really hard line to walk, I think, that I'm still trying to figure out. I mean, how do you guys feel about that?
About, like,
about
how to
attributing
about
sexuality or something like this to a historical figure?
I think because we don't, like, what the information we have on Sappho is barely anything.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's really difficult to
say one way or the other anyway.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe sometimes staying away from labels is a good thing as far as saying she was this. But I think giving all the information we know or all the possible information is important as well. Because I know with other figures like Alexander the Great or Achilles, there's sort of very clear evidence that they were in homosexual relationships and that got erased for a lot of us going through the history. So I think it's important.
Well, I think you can even tell that in Homer's epic poetry, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Achilles has this very homoerotic relationship with
Patroclus?
What seems to be several men, but mostly Patroclus.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think maybe staying away from labels is a good thing, but also giving all the information.
And
I think not erasing what those historical figures mean to people and their identities now. Because those people who share certain characteristics with people who have these specific identities now, they'll identify with that. And so it means something to them.
Right. Yeah. Which I think is great. Like, I think specifically today we talk a lot about identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being able to find someone in history who you identify with is so important.
Yeah.
And I don't think it comes down to labeling that. It's
right.
I feel that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess for this, I'll say for Sappho, she writes many, many lines about women, Aphrodite, the beauty of women, etc., which I think can be used in a romantic way for women. Like, if you want to impress your girlfriends, recite her some Sappho, you know?
Touching back to what you were saying, it's possible that she probably wrote poetry on many topics, but most of her works, the works that we have, they are expressing lesbian love and those are the ones that are, like I said, they're survived and then they're most intact.
And I think that's a good point, too. The work that we do have, which, like, okay, if she wrote about 10,000 lines and we have 650 of them, and
that's
a lot of them are about women,
yeah,
that makes it, what, about 6% about women? So far, at least.
I have a question about who her audience would have been.
I had the same question.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find specific information, of course, because we don't have a lot about her.
You think there was not a Sappho fan club?
I think there probably was a Sappho fan club.
True. I don't know who they were.
But I think the way she's talked about as far as being the 10th muse or the poetess.
Yeah.
I think she was probably well known by everyone.
Okay. Because there might be a, if she had a primarily male audience or something like that, then then it could be possible that she's writing more from their perspective so that when they read it, it's, do you see what I'm
saying?
Like
through the male gaze.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That would make sense. But I guess a lot of it, well, no, I guess even if it is more of a like I or me phrasing, it could also be through a male gaze though as well.
Yeah. So
that's an interesting take.
And I'm not sure. I would have to get more deep into the actual wording of the poetry,
yeah,
I think. But
which we have some coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So look forward to that.
Yeah.
I think this is probably a good time for us to take a break.
I think that'd be a great idea.
Enjoy your ad. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you my little surprise about where we found some of her fragments.
I'm so excited.
Ooh. Ooh. I bet Barbara Jean would like Sappho poetry.
Yeah.
She seems like a lady.
She likes treats.
I like treats, too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, getting back into Sappho, there has been a continuous interest in her work since the Victorian period. Even in 2004, there was a discovery of what I'm going to say, quote-unquote, new papyrus scroll, known as the Cologne Papyrus, which has actually helped complete an already cataloged poem fragment. The completion of this resulted in what's titled Poem 58, where Sappho considers themes of youth and old age, which is a different take, I think, on Sappho.
Yeah.
Which is the second complete poem that we have of hers now, in 2004. So much of Sappho's work that we found, along with Homer's work, Greek playwrights, Plato, and St. Paul's work, come from what is called the Oxyrhynchus.
Okay.
Do you know what the Oxyrhynchus is?
No, but I'm pretty sure you're going to tell us what an Oxyrhynchus
is. I want to hear guesses because no one's going to guess this.
Okay.
Oxyrhynchus. I'm not supposed to read forward.
How's it spelled?
Oxyrhynchus.
Well, it has the word cuss in it.
Oxyrhynchus.
Like, so it'd be like trash talk. Like garbage talk. Is it
okay?
It was found in a trash heap.
Yeah.
How'd y'all know?
Literally because Sally just said trash
We're
talk.
So fucking smart. We're so fucking smart.
The Oxyrhynchus is a giant trash heap from ancient Egypt located near, I think it's pronounced El Banasa in Egypt.
So it was literally just the dump.
Wow.
They found it at the dump.
Yeah, it's south of Cairo, down the Nile. And you might be saying it's a pretty strange place to find pieces like this, but actually ancient trash heaps, like our own landfills today, are a great place to look for everyday life objects if you're an archaeologist.
So what you're saying is we should go to the dump and go hunt for stuff.
Oh, no.
I don't want to study my own culture, though, because I hate my own culture.
I really feel like Sally and I just took a math test, and we did the wrong formula, but we got the right answer.
Yeah, honestly, I'm kind of upset because I wanted to surprise you.
Do we want to take that again? Ashley, what is an oxyrhynchus?
No, the moment's gone. But it's trash heaps like this that have actually helped historians and archaeologists explore many different times in history. The trash heaps are anaerobic environments, which just means it lacks free oxygen. And it actually stops compressed trash from breaking down.
Which means a lot for our current landfills.
Which means a lot for our current landfills. I'm glad you picked up on that because that's also important.
Yeah.
But archaeologists 100 years from now can actually come back and dig and be like, oh, they used a lot of plastic.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's kind of what they're good for.
What the hell are they going to find? Plastic and
diapers.
Yeah.
Lots of straws.
Probably lots of straws. No, those are in the sea.
Oh.
Junk.
But this being able to stop it from breaking down is exactly what preserved the historical record of Britain's metamorphosis from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age, which archaeologists were able to find in East Chisenbury. I think I'm saying that right. Sorry, England.
Chisenbury.
And it also helped us find Japan's, I think it's pronounced Jomon era, which was how we discovered the development of trade and rice farming.
Oh.
Those are just two examples of how trash heaps were able to help the historical record. And I think this is so brilliant. since these trash heaps pile within the strata, they create really nice, easy-to-read timelines for archaeologists, since that's what they study and they look at, kind of in a geology way.
Yeah.
But yeah, trash heap or not, this is the place we found a lot of fragments of ancient literature. And to give you guys an idea of how painstaking it is for archaeologists to put it together, I want to share with you a recently discovered fresco story.
Okay.
This comes from the Heritage Daily website, which is heritagedaily.com. Surprisingly easy. it's from an article posted on July 26th of 2019.
Okay.
So this is just a couple months ago. In the article, it discusses the work being done by the teams of the American University of Beirut and the University of Tübingen.
Okay.
Did I say that right in German? Tübingen.
You looked up the pronunciation.
I know, but I can't even read my own. I can't even read my pronunciation guide.
Let me see the notes. Let's see. There was a video.
Tübingen. There was an umlaut over the U, but I couldn't put it in Google Docs.
Tübingen.
Sure.
I don't
Ashley
know.
Marie, we looked at a video on YouTube from a website called
pronouncenames.com. It looked really legit. But I did also look up the place. anyway, these two universities are documenting one of the oldest wall frescoes from the ancient Near East, which was found in the ruins of a palace built around 1900 BCE.
Oh.
Wow.
That is old.
That's very old.
That is old.
Old as book.
The palace was actually begun excavating in 2001. But the first part of this wall was found in 2005. In this article from July 26, 2019, they still only have fragments pieced together of this fresco. However, it is enough to tell the scenes that it depicts. And they include a hunting scene, a procession, and a tree of life. Do you guys know what that is?
This is from 4,000 years ago? Did I get that right?
Yes.
We have a fresco from 4,000 years ago.
From 4,000 years ago, but we still only have fragments that are showing us kind of what these scenes look like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to put this all together for you guys, this is a 14-year dig since they found the first piece of the wall to July 26, 2019. And they still only have fragments of this fresco. But it's incredible. I'm going to post the article on our website.
Okay.
So you can read a little bit more about the dig and the work that they're doing. But it also has photos that the American University of Beirut has put out for the public to see exactly the amount of work that they've been able to do.
Yeah. I can't imagine the amount of work that goes into just sifting through. And just the process of doing archaeology to me is...
I'm too impatient.
I'm going to say two things here. So one, if you want to see an example of the amount of work that archaeology takes that is sort of kind of funny and silly, I highly recommend watching Time Team.
Time Team.
It's on Amazon Prime. It's a British show. I think they have like two or three seasons on there. But it's actually hosted by the guy who played Baldrick in Blackadder.
Oh.
And it's amazing. He's so tiny.
He's teeny tiny.
I'm gonna have to check this out.
It is so good. It's so good. They have this like very country English country man. Mm-hmm. He's brilliant. He's my favorite. But my second story is an embarrassing, actually, as a child story.
Yes.
I used to love playing Tomb Raider as a kid. And I watched a lot of Indiana Jones as well.
As a child does.
As a child should. Now, those two things really stuck with me. And I remember having this conversation with my dad. I had to have been pretty young. Mm-hmm. But I was like, what does Lara Croft do? Like, what's her job? And she was like, well, I'm pretty sure she's an archaeologist. At which point my child brain went, yep, I want to be an archaeologist. And I used to call it that for a really long time. And then I got a BA in theater, and now I'm like about 14 weeks from having a master's in literary studies, which is nowhere near archaeology.
You know what? I think it is.
Yeah.
Well, it's archaeology for words.
I mean, it is. There is historicism as a form of literary critique. I'm actually learning about this in a class that I'm taking right now, and I just read several essays that were very much against historicism that I railed against.
I would say you got your master's in literary archaeologism.
Literary archaeologism.
So I've read a little bit about historicism, mm-hmm. I feel like. But it's basically reading something through the lens of the time it was created, right?
It's a social document.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
See, I too am very much, I don't know that you can point to everything and say that, but mm-hmm. I tend to sort of take that viewpoint a lot of the time, I feel like.
Reading a little bit more about it, I'm only a couple weeks into really diving into this, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel like I'm somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Like, I think literature is an art form, and defining what literature is very difficult to do as well, yeah. because of, I shouldn't say that. Defining literature is very hard. Yeah. That's where I'm going to leave that.
Yeah.
But I also think authors don't come up with their stories in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of what they experience and read about and see in their daily lives comes out. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I feel like it does a disservice to any work if you say, we're not going to put any history in it. Mm-hmm. Or the opposite, if you say, we're only going to put history
yeah.
in it, and we're not going to take it as just a work.
Right.
So you have to find a good balance, I feel like.
I think so, too. And I don't think I'm for one school of thought or the other when it comes
yeah.
to historicism versus formalism. I think mm-hmm. I'm somewhere in between.
Yeah.
But there doesn't seem to be a school of literary analysis for that. That's okay. I'll
start your own school.
I'll publish my own papers, and it'll be a form of analysis.
Yeah. Davisism.
My dad will be very happy with that.
Yeah.
Davisism. So now that we've kind of talked about the work that goes into finding her poems or fragments, we want to go ahead and read a few poems.
Yeah.
And we're going to start with one that we actually have two translations of, and I think that might be
yeah.
really interesting to talk about the difference mm-hmm. in translations. So, Sally, I think you're going first. Who's the translator?
Julia Dubnoff? Dubnoff?
Okay.
D-U-B-N-O-F-F. And some of these translations, like we mentioned earlier, they're fragments, so there is some missing text from them. What we decided to do, we're giving you this little disclaimer first, and then if there is missing text, we're just going to have a pause.
A longer pause.
Yeah,
a long
pause.
Okay.
So let me start this one.
Do we have the fragment number by chance? I don't know if I put it on mine, actually. Ooh. Mine just says LP16, which I don't know what that means in terms of Julie Dubnoff's translation.
I believe it.
I don't know. Anyways. You'll be able to find it based on the lyrics.
Yeah. Some say an army of horsemen, some of foot soldiers, some of ships, is the fairest thing on the black earth. But I say it is what one loves. It is it's very easy to make this clear to everyone. For Helen, by far surpassing mortals in beauty, left the best of all husbands and sailed to Troy. Mindful of neither her child nor her dear parents, but with one glimpse she was seduced by Aphrodite. For easily bent and nimbly, has reminded me now of Anictoria, who is not here. I would much prefer to see the lovely way she walks and the radiant glance of her face than the warm the war chariots of the Lydians or their foot soldiers in arms.
I really like that translation.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to read you a translation of the same poem or fragment of a poem by Jim Powell. And this comes from his translation of Sappho's poems from the Oxford University Press, which was published in 2007. Some say thronging cavalry, some say foot soldiers. Others call a fleet the most beautiful of sights the dark earth offers. But I say it's whatever you love best. And it's easy to make this understood by everyone, for she who surpassed all humankind in beauty, Helen, abandoning her husband, the best of men, went sailing off to the shores of Troy and never spent a thought on her child or loving parents. When the goddess seduced her wits and left her to wander, she forgot them all. She could not remember anything but longing, and lightly straying aside, lost her way. But that reminds me now, Anictoria. She's not here, and I'd rather see her lovely step, her sparkling glance, and her face than gaze on all the troops in Lydia in their chariots and glittering armor.
I think this is incredibly interesting.
I do too.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the translations first, and then I want to talk about why I think this is a very interesting poem.
Yes.
So, as a listener, how do both translations sound to you?
So, you can tell it's the same poem. You can tell it's translated versions of the same original text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, the subtle differences in how they choose to translate give you a completely different feeling.
Yeah.
Yes.
Reading this out loud, it made me realize that, like, why I picked this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's parts of Julia's that I want to pick out and, like, mush together.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think translation is so difficult anyway, because
mm-hmm.
you're trying to transpose it to fit a language it was not written in and choose the best words for that.
And I think particularly for poetry,
mm-hmm.
it becomes very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think translation is such an interesting subject for poetry. Because
we should find a translator to interview.
Yes.
That would be really interesting.
I mean, UTD has
a whole translation department.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
we should talk to someone there.
And poetry in particular, just because it has a certain cadence or what it makes you feel in the original language, and
mm-hmm.
trying to recreate that in a different language
is
always so difficult. You can't just translate it word for word and literally.
Right.
And sometimes there's also cultural things that don't quite transfer.
Yeah.
So it's really, really difficult. And it's very interesting to see people who translate things so differently.
Yeah. And I think both of these translators have done a very good job of getting the feeling
mm-hmm.
in, like, the shifting feeling that you get from, like, one emotion to another throughout
mm-hmm.
the poem. I think they've both done that beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
Some of their word choices, though, I'm very interested in.
Well, and particularly, I think the part about Helen and when she's... It was... In the first one, it says she's seduced by Aphrodite.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting, like, choice of words to me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in the fact that it's a female translator and a male translator.
Yes.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the word choice.
Well, and to me, this one almost reads like she's gone feral or something, because it says something about she's lost or astray.
Uh-huh. And she can't remember her family, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get that from the first one.
Yeah, and for the first one, it seems more like she fell in love.
It felt more romantic.
Yes.
Yeah, the second one was very...
Knowledge, almost.
Yeah, it felt a little... I don't want to say colder, but it was just...
I don't know what you mean. I think it feels that way until she realizes that person's... What's the name?
It was like almost like
Anictoria is not here, you know?
Yeah.
It does almost feel like the poem itself is like, I'm gonna say Sappho as the author, right?
Mm-hmm.
It feels as if Sappho is conveying this beginning of the story of Troy, and then has like her own, like, Helen never remembered her family. She never remembered this, but I've forgotten something. What did I forget? Anictoria. oh, she's not here. And I think it's like this very interesting switch in thought for mm-hmm. a poet
yeah.
that I find very, very interesting. Yeah. But anyway, the reason I really liked this poem, I'm so excited.
Oh my gosh.
The reason I like it is because it seems like it's the first time that I've read a woman poet acting as a historian of sorts.
Yeah.
And discussing the beginning of the siege of Troy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know Homer, we know the Iliad, and we know the Odyssey. But I didn't realize that she even discussed Helen and Troy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think this is very interesting. And, you know, she talks about other stuff as well in this poem. And I think it's kind of a lot to take in one poem.
Yeah.
But it is kind of the first time we see her acting as a historian,
yeah.
or any ancient Greek woman acting mm-hmm. as a historian in my experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very excited about that. So that's why I picked this one. Is there a reason you picked it, Sally?
I like the words. The words look nice.
Well, you said you had a thought about why it was interesting, right?
Yeah. I don't remember why. I think you touched on it to where when you think of the Trojan War, you think of wartime and, you know, like war documentaries
yeah.
and stuff. And this was a very different view on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I find it interesting. It's also that contrast between Ares and war and that sort of thing and Aphrodite and love and
uh-huh.
beauty.
Yeah.
That I think is really interesting to butt those two together.
Yeah.
Because she begins talking about chariots and wartime and
uh-huh.
all of this, you know.
It's something about like their glittering armor or mm-hmm. the foot soldiers and thronging cavalry, I think is a phrase
yeah.
I really like from Powell's translation.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do think that's very interesting to put these two gods who represent these two different virtues,
mm-hmm.
because that's what they are in ancient Greece, is they are virtues,
yeah.
Against each other,
mm-hmm.
I think is very, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
It seems very Dionysian as well, because it's this conflicting of ideas, right? But it's also, I just put together that she's a very Dionysian figure, and it's because what we know about her is so fragmented. Because Dionysia is a god who's fragmented and literally broken apart and put back together.
Mm.
Huh. My whole Nietzsche class is coming back to me, and I hope Dr. Baumbach is proud. Anyway, do you have anything else you want to say about that one, KB?
It's so much to take in. I can't get over, the thing that's sticking out in my head is the Aphrodite seduced her.
Yeah, I think that's a very good word choice from Julia.
Well, and so much we talk about Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And that, oh, Paris was the one that took Helen.
Yeah,
But he really wasn't.
No.
Because, you know, it came from that whole, oh, who's the most beautiful goddess,
mm-hmm.
and he picked Aphrodite and the whole thing,
yeah.
which, Paris, I have lots of feelings about Paris and him being dumb.
Bless his cotton socks.
So, it's interesting to me that it's put more on
the
Aphrodite.
Goddess.
Yes.
It's her fault, yeah.
Well, not really fault, maybe, but just like she's the one.
The instigator, maybe?
Yeah, and she's the active party in this rather than Paris.
Yeah.
So that's what I keep coming back to that.
I think that's what really struck me, specifically if we're talking about a woman acting as poet and historian like Homer,
mm-hmm.
is that she's not blaming it on a man.
Yeah.
She's actually putting this on Aphrodite being in charge of everything, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
Like you were saying.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can go ahead and go on to our second poem. Is that you or me, Sally?
That's you.
That's me. Okay.
I'm ready. More poetry.
This is also from Jim Powell. And I'm so sorry I don't have a fragment number. In his book, though, it's the same book from Oxford University Press in 2007. It's labeled as LP2.
Okay.
So you guys can find it. Okay. It reads, "Come to me from Crete to the sacred recess of this temple. Here you will find an apple grove to welcome you, and upon the altars, frankincense fuming. Here ice water babbles among the apple branches. The musk roses have overshadowed all this ground, and out of the flickering leafage settles entrancement. There are meadows, too, where the horses graze knee-deep in flowers. Yes, and the breezes blow here honey sweet and softer.
Here, you take a garland now also, Cypress, graceful in the goblets of gold-mixed nectar with the gladness of our festivities, and pour the libation.
So, I feel like there's also a lot to take in here.
Yes.
But what I liked most about this poem is the nature imagery that she has in it. I'll come back to the apples in a little bit, but it sounds like a divine place to be, right? And it's also so Greek. There's a lot of Greek nature imagery in everything. But in other Greek literature I've read, it seems like when meadows are mentioned, it's usually young maidens in this beautiful pastoral scene where they're happened upon by a Greek god.
Okay.
And that god usually initiates a sexual relationship, and it's sometimes consensual and sometimes sometimes not entirely clear if it's consensual or not. So there's this idea of being in a very beautiful place where you can meet a divine being, but something else happens and it could be horrific.
Yeah.
Whereas here it's very welcoming. It feels warm, like I can feel the sun on my skin, you know. I can smell the flowers and see the horses grazing.
Yeah. It's almost protected.
Protected, yeah, I think, is a great word.
At the beginning, it's something about come to me from Crete to this temple. Is that
a recess temple?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it feels very sheltered.
Almost. Yeah, I agree. I think it's very interesting take on it.
I feel like instead of you said initiate a sexual relationship. Like instead of doing that, it's just like, they're going to make love.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it could be like, yeah.
Barry White's playing.
It's like, yeah, there's probably people having sex, but also you can like come and chill out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to drink some wine? Do you want to like sit in the water? Whatever. Do what you want.
So does this mean we're going to have wine and go swimming afterwards?
Oh my God, that sounds amazing. It is so hot. That'd be great.
Yeah.
But I want to throw this little fact at you guys and see if it changes how you read the poem. So in Sappho's poetry, a lot of analysis will say that apples are said to be a symbol for the feminine or feminine sensuality.
Okay.
So I think this is interesting when we think about here you will find an apple grove to welcome you. Yes,
I had
Sally.
A thought. Okay. Because you said apples is a symbol for feminine sensuality. It reminded me of when we talked about a few episodes, Spring Awakening.
Uh-huh.
And one of the lyrics, it was, those breasts, I mean, God, please just let those apples fall.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is a line in that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
That also, to me, because isn't one of the tasks of Hercules to go and steal an apple?
Maybe.
I think he has to steal it from, like, a sacred, it's a special apple.
Do you say Hercules or Heracles?
Listen, I don't know anymore.
So,
I've heard both.
I've heard both too, and I think maybe it's because I'm so westernized with the Disney movie Hercules.
Yeah.
And I understand that's supposed to be kind of named after Hera, the queen goddess, who has a wrath, let me tell you. But, so I understand how it should maybe be pronounced Heracles,
but
I don't like it.
Yeah, well, and I've seen it spelled.
I've seen it spelled Heracles
so.
As well.
Yeah.
I don't know, I just wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Well, also, going back to this movie, what sounds better, Hercules or Heracles?
Hercules.
I can hear both now, but maybe it's because I've been hearing it.
What's the gladiator?
Heracles!
That sounds it sounds very close to hairy knees.
Listen, hairy knees cannot be a hero.
I've got hairy knees right now, and I could be a hero.
I mean, but it's not your name,
it
actually.
It could be.
Your name
they
is
call
Harry.
Me Hairy Knees.
Oh, my gosh.
If you're Hairy Knees, I'm the human skin mark.
Oh, dear.
Okay, let's go back to Sappho's poetry. Are you done? Okay, I'm going to talk to KB then.
Okay.
Stop. This is a cry for help.
So, if knowing that apples could represent the feminine or the feminine sensuality, do you take anything else different from this poem?
Listen, they were partying on Lesbos. That's what I'm going to say.
Well, I think I already kind of mentioned the Apple Grove line, right? Uh-huh. But it's also here ice water babbles among the apple branches.
Okay.
I think is a strange term. Because I wouldn't call it an... If I'm going to talk about the branches of an apple tree, I would say the apple tree branches and not just the apple branches.
Hmm.
So I think that's I don't know, for me that was a weird term.
Yeah. I wish that I knew her original weird Greek dialect.
Yes.
So that I could just get into this more specifically.
How long would it take us to learn ancient Greek and then to learn that dialect?
I ask myself this all the time about many languages. Like, how fast can I learn ancient Chinese? You know, and...
Girl.
Yeah.
Okay, there's this professor at our school.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first professor I had at UTD. I don't know if I should name him or not.
I mean, we're saying only good things about
him. Yeah, I only have great... His name is Dr. Farmer.
He's wonderful.
He is the most terrific human being to ever human being.
Probably one of the best professors I've ever had.
One of the best professors I've ever had, hands down.
Yeah.
And he has these pro tips, but they're like pro farmer life tips. And they range from anything. And they've always stuck with me since mm-hmm. my first semester. When I get stressed out, I hear Dr. Farmer, you need to find a mental hobby.
Yeah.
I'm like, thanks, Dr. Farmer, I will.
Mm-hmm.
And this turned out to be my mental hobby. But, yeah, no, Dr. Farmer is fantastic. I don't know where I was going with this. Ancient Chinese.
Yes.
Every time I'm sitting in class and I'm not really enjoying myself, I ask myself, how quickly can I learn ancient Chinese and go work with Dr. Farmer?
Yeah.
Because I'm just like, I would love my job.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I... Mm-hmm. We should learn ancient Greek.
Yeah.
And then ancient Chinese and go work with Dr. Farmer.
Yeah. And just talk about women's roles in society in ancient China. Yes. I'm very interested.
We could talk about Ben Zhao all the time.
Yes.
Oh.
All the time.
Anyway, getting back to this poem, like, it just sounds so pleasant,
mm-hmm.
this place that she's describing.
Yeah.
Like, if this was a travel advertisement.
I could see this like on Airbnb.
Yes. If this is her Airbnb listing and she's reading this in voiceover, showing us this beautiful meadow and the babbling brook
mm-hmm.
and this grove of possibly women, I don't know. Then
it's a grove of women.
It's a grove of women. I would 100% book this Airbnb. You know, like it's just so
lovely.
I want to go there. It also has a sense of nostalgia without being nostalgic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I feel like I know this place, or like I could remember this place,
mm-hmm.
but I've never been. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if there's a word for that.
I'm wondering if that's maybe some kind of biological or cultural... It's almost like it's that
memory.
That pastoral thing.
Yeah.
I feel like we... crave this sort of going back to nature specifically
100%
specifically mm-hmm. because we're all so busy now and life kind of drags you down a little bit. I feel like a lot of people are feeling that urge to sort of get back to those things.
Can we go camping? Listen, Ashley, I said we can go camping. It'll be intense.
I don't want to go camping with you if you're gonna make puns like that.
Same joke to last. I like it.
But yeah, totally. We should totally.
We should go camping.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's go ahead and move on. Do you have a second poem, Sally?
I do have a second poem, Ashley.
What is it?
Okay.
Oh my god. Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Okay, what's your...
Step aside, Nick Kroll. I'm going to be on.
What's your second poem?
So, this was another translation by Jim Powell in the same book, The Poetry of Sappho, in the Oxford University Press, which was published in 2007.
We cite our sources here.
No, but I don't know which poem it is.
That's fine.
Yeah. In my eyes, he matches the gods, that man who sits there facing you. Any man, whatever, listening from close by to the sweetness of your voice as you talk, the sweetness of your laughter. Yes, that I swear it sets the heart sets the heart to shaking inside my breast. Since once I look at you for a moment, I can't speak any longer. But my tongue breaks down, and then all at once a subtle fire races inside my skin. My eyes can't see a thing, and a whirring whistle thrums at my hearing. Cold sweat covers me, and a trembling takes a hold of me all over. I'm greener than the grass. Is it appear to myself to be little short of dying? But all of this must be endured, since even a poor.
End of the poem.
Honestly, I'm not good at reading. I was that one kid in the class, and just like the.
I got so annoyed at that.
And then the dog. Like a duck.
I was a kid who would get in trouble for being 10 pages ahead of the class.
Mm.
And be like, I don't know where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I was reading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what I liked about this poem is, first, I could relate to it. It's about unrequited love.
Me. Mood.
And
we're hip. Mood.
Me.
Okay, so I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, you're good. But that's what I really liked. I could really relate to it. And you like the imagery where she's just like, I can't even function right now. That's how much.
Yeah.
I'm just head over heels for you.
I love the lines. In my eyes, he matches the gods. That man who sits there facing you, any man, whatever, listening from close by to the sweetness of your voice. Whatever man is listening to you right now, he's a god.
And here I am, because
of you, you know, like,
and I'm over here, and
I'm alone,
and I'm gonna be so.
Again, we get back to the YouTuber apology of like mascara running down your face.
Yeah, I'm alone.
So same. This reminds me of a Billie Eilish song.
I wish you were gay.
Yes.
Yes. I listened to her album, I'm not joking, I listened to her album today 5 times back to back.
I listened to it today too while I was driving home.
I was doing it while cleaning and then doing homework, so it wasn't as exciting.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I listen to that album almost daily.
Yeah.
It's such a good album. Mm-hmm. She's so young.
Yeah.
Maybe she's the next Sappho.
Maybe.
Oh.
She's Sappho.
Probably.
This also somewhat reminds me of, like, Emily Dickinson and some of the more love-related poetry she does.
I would say.
We need to add Emily Dickinson to the list.
Mm-hmm.
Hey,
I love her so much.
Maybe we should talk about Sappho.
I love Emily Dickinson so much. And she's not macabre. She's perfect.
Hey, we're macabre.
I am macabre.
A macabre manicotti.
No.
I want to know what a macabre manicotti looks like.
It looks like headstones.
No, it's manicotti. There's just a bunch of marinara sauce on it.
Yucky.
It's supposed to be macabre and bloody.
Bloody?
Bloody.
Oh, I'm like, what's bloody? Bloody. Oh, God. Well, I think we might be getting a little slap happy, so I'm going to bring us to the third and final poem.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about why after, but I think it brings up a really good image that I think could kind of sum up Legendary Lasses.
Okay.
So it reads, oh, I'm sorry, this is by Julia Dubnoff, and it is Fragment 5.
Okay.
He is dying, Aphrodite. Luxuriant Adonis is dying. What should we do? Beat your breast, young maidens, and tear your garments in grief. Now, this image of beating your breast, young maidens, mm-hmm. it's not an image that we see attributed to young maidens.
Yeah.
It's a very warlike thing. It's a very mm-hmm. passionate grief thing. But I think it's a really good phrase for Legendary Lasses.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we want to inspire women.
Yeah.
And, we also want to inspire men, too. But we want to inspire people to not be afraid to jump in, make waves, beat your breasts, and change the course of history.
Yeah.
So I really liked kind of closing this episode with this image of beat your breasts, young maidens.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think about that?
I love that.
I really like that. But when it said integer garments in grief, I think of Donald Glover in Community, where he's just freaking out and he's just like dragging himself across the floor. He's just like, you know what I mean?
You've got a very different image to what Legendary Lasses
is. I know, but
it's
just like tear your garments in grief, where you're just like tearing your clothes.
Like Superman stuff.
Yeah, and they're just like so just distraught. I don't know why I thought of that, and then I feel really stupid for thinking that.
No,
way.
That's fair. That's fair.
But I like the beat your breath, because yeah. I think a lot of the time women are told to be quiet.
Mm-hmm. And just like have like a couple of tears shit down.
But beating your breast in grief.
Yeah.
It's very
honorable.
It's honorable, yeah. And it's so reactive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what for a long time in women's history is we weren't allowed to be as most reactive.
We're supposed to be very demure.
Restrained.
Yeah.
Because if we're not, we're crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, Taryn Gunn.
I mean, and it, you know, this could be seen as crazy, but whatever. Like, I just think it's a really good image to kind of sum up Legendary Lasses, specifically if we're talking about Sappho, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
But anyway, do you guys have anything else you want to say about Sappho?
I really liked learning more about her. I had always heard about her before, but not.
You're our gauge for the audience. How did
yeah,
we do?
I think you did pretty good.
Are you just saying it because we're sitting here? Not even 3 feet.
Absurdly close to each other. We're absurdly
yes.
close to each other.
No, I'm going to go trash you anonymously.
Give us a 1-star rating.
No, I would never do that. But I really think you guys brought a lot of good information. And I think we covered a lot of things that
yeah.
I found really interesting. And I'm glad that we covered things like what a primary source is, what a secondary source is.
Yeah.
I think those are really important for our podcast in general, because
yeah.
I think those are the things we're going to be using, and
yeah.
We also covered a lot of literary things. We're a very interdisciplinary podcast,
yeah.
almost, I think.
Thanks, UTD.
Yeah, we're history based, but also, especially with this topic,
this you have to
literary.
Be text literary based,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I hope my talking about historians' work wasn't boring.
No.
I liked it. I thought it was nifty.
Yeah.
Cool. Great. Thanks, guys. I'm just a history nerd at heart, which I guess is why we have a history podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else we want to say? All right. Well, then make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We are at Legendary Lasses on all 3 platforms. Mm-hmm. If you have any suggestions on topics or people you want us to cover or any feedback at all, you can email us at legendarylasses@gmail.com.
Also, you can visit our website. It's legendarylasses@wordpress.com. And that's where we include all of the notes from the episode, anything we say we're going to add, pictures, links. We'll post it on our website for each episode of the podcast. We're also now on several platforms, and we're continuing to expand where our podcast is available. If you do happen to use any platform like Apple Podcasts, where it lets you rate, please be sure to rate us and leave a review. And if not, we'd still love to hear from you via email or on Facebook. Let us know what you think.
And on our Anchor page, we do have a donate button, which is very awkward for me to bring up now. But if you would like to donate to us, any of the money that we make from the podcast or donations that are given to us are going to be going into funding the podcast.
Yeah.
That means helping us get research books, helping us get mics for better audio quality so it sounds better for you guys,
mm-hmm.
And overall just help us be able to make better podcast episodes for you guys. So that is available on our Anchor website, which mm-hmm. is anchor.fm/legendarylasses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that it?
I think that's all.
Who's doing our outro?
I guess I can do the outro.
Sally's
I haven't said anything yet. So. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Now, go out, make waves, change history, stay legendary, and kick some ass.
Bye.
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 Bye.